Called order, it's 1:15, April 7th, and we have present for the record representatives Cott, Guerra, Wilson, and myself, McGuire. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. We have a long meeting today. If people have to use the facilities, feel free to do so. I'd prefer not to take an official break just to kind of try to get through this, but let me know, slip me a note if there's something that comes up. In this order, Senate Bill 54, Senate Bill 298, House Bill 413, House Bill 347, and House Bill 276. So without further ado, Senator Dyson and Senate Bill 54.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Guerra.
I've spoken to Representative Cott, and I've spoken to you a little bit about some of these bills, but if we've got so many bills that we go ahead with, there are some that I don't think, there might be some that none of us have any questions on at this point from pre-reading the packets. I mean, this is this first one I don't have any on. And
I tried to do it in order of least contentious to most, but you may disagree with my order.
I'm just thinking if we know we don't have any questions on some of these because we've already discussed them and thought them through, maybe we can save some time and pass those out much more quickly.
Yeah.
Like this first one, I don't have any questions on after going through it.
Okay. I agree, and the only thing I want to do is make sure I take public testimony. I have only one person besides Senator Dyson. Are there other members that have questions about the bill? Then are you suggesting then we just sort of skip the formalities?
I guess for each of these, I know that one or two of us don't have any, but that's not fair to the other committee members who maybe do have questions. So
What I've done, I mean, with fairness to the members, is I've said, we've got to keep pressing through with the schedule. So let me know or Shalon know if you have concerns, and I haven't received any. So I'm going to continue forward today, moving bills out. Unless there's concern. So what I do is abbreviate your opening statement, Senator Dyson, knowing that you've got support, and then I'll go to Christina Pate, who's the only person I have for public testimony so far. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing this. The head of the sexual assault unit at the Anchorage Police Department came to me a year and a half ago and said some judges were not allowing rape and assault victims to get a restraining order because it was not specific in Alaska's law. Some were, and I think, Madam Chair, you've worked a lot on restraining orders, and so all this bill does primarily is add sexual assault to the two other categories, which are stalking and domestic violence. It, in its present version, puts the sexual assault in with the stalking, which was far more applicable. It does a couple more things that are a little bit unique, and I think improve the existing statutes, but it requires the victim, alleged victim, to let the judge know if there are any other pending actions between the victim and the perpetrator. You probably, in your past adventures in this area, have found out that some restraining orders have been requested based on spite or trying to maneuver custody, disillusionment, and divorce settings. That almost never, I think, comes up in sexual assault, but slight improvement. And that's all. And I appreciate the support. If it's all right with you, I'm going to go back to finance where I'm supposed to be.
Please do.
Jason can answer any and all the questions better than I.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Okay, and we've been joined by Representative Gruenberg and Representative Anderson, and we are on the first bill, Senate Bill 54, and what we've agreed to, Representative Gruenberg, we're hoping we have your support, is to try to speed up the bill hearings for those bills that aren't controversial, and I put them in order of what I perceive to be least controversial to most, and so we're hoping that there isn't a whole lot of controversy on this one, and if there isn't, then we're hoping we can move it through quickly. I have one person to testify, and that's Christina Pate.
Hi, yes, thank you, Representative McGuire. My name is Christine Pate, and I am an attorney with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 54. I've been working in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault for over 13 years, and as you all know, sexual assault is a very serious issue in our state. We rank number one for sexual assault, and our rate of forcible rate is 2.5 times the national average. I just want to amplify quickly on some of the things that Senator Dyson said. As you know, this would create a remedy for sexual assault victims who are not intimate partners with the person who sexually assaulted them. We feel like it's kind of a hole in the current system. We've had several people come to our shelter programs who have been sexually assaulted, have not had that intimate partner relationship that's required under the current protection order statute, but need to get, for their own safety or peace of mind, need to get a protection order. And under the current scheme, they can't do that. And the only way they could do it is if they were to argue perhaps that they actually had engaged in sexual contact with the perpetrator, which of course is kind of a reprehensible thing to place someone, place a victim in that situation, and it also would have detrimental effects on a criminal case were they to be going forward with a criminal case. So we feel like this is a much needed remedy. I've over the years heard several people have this same problem. Our member agency, STAR, has come to me repeatedly with this request. And so we're asking you to please pass this out of committee. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I don't want to take up too much of your time. It sounds like you have a full schedule.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And yeah, and I just see this as a further cleanup that I was involved in the stalking bill that would allow protective orders in that area. And it's just some states went down this path early on of sort of couching the whole issue of protective orders in personal relationships in terms of folks that you see and know on a regular basis as opposed to those who might be strangers to you. And it's just an interesting sort of relic of our state law, and I see this as a further cleanup of it, but a very important cleanup for those people who are in those situations. It's terribly frightening and certainly of some comfort, although you can never be sure, but it's certainly of some comfort to have these protective orders when you've had the unfortunate circumstance of a sexual assault. So thank you for your testimony and all your advocacy on the issue. And are there questions for Ms. Pate? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I promised I wouldn't have any questions. All of a sudden I do. Ms. Pate, I'm going to vote to move this bill out. I think it's a good bill. I just have, if you have a short answer to this one question, I'm scratching my head. If somebody's arrested for sexual assault or sentenced for it, it's a standard condition of bail or sentencing that there be no contact by the person who did it with the victim. But there must be some circumstance where there's no arrest and therefore the bail condition and sentencing condition don't apply. Is that
correct? I mean, okay. Unfortunately, what we see is that there's an under prosecution in this area in particular.
I understand. And,
some of those people don't have criminal prosecutions going on.
Right.
The other portion of that is that this provides more and more specific remedies than a criminal no contact order, and in that sense, is probably more enforceable if there's a violation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 54? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none. Public testimony is closed. It brings the Senate bill back before us. Is there any further discussion or amendments on the bill? Okay, hearing none. Representative Cott?
With that, Madam Chair, then I would move CS for Senate Bill 54 out of committee with individual recommendations and fiscal amendment.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none. Senate Bill 54 moves. That brings us to Senate Bill 298.
Thank you.
Press challenges, claims, and liabilities. And let's see here. Oh, so the bill sponsor is Senator Seekins. Mr. Hove is here. How are you today, Brian?
I'm doing well, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Welcome to House Judiciary. We're not as tough over here, by the way.
It's tough.
Gosh, after my fourth eminent domain.
I know it.
Whew.
Don't get me started, Madam Chair.
Have you found it rough over there?
The Senate, yeah.
Okay.
Can I get started?
No.
It's not Brian's fault, though. We love Brian.
We like Ralph, too. Okay, so tell us about Senate Bill 298.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Brian Hove, staff to Senator Seekins. He apologizes. He was not able to be here today. He's attending the Republican conference in Fairbanks this weekend. SB 298 is another in a sequence of trust bills that have been introduced in the legislature since, I believe, the first big rewrite was in 1997. When Senator Seekins joined the legislature in 2003, we had a couple of trust bills, one which we worked collaboratively with the chair. And what this bill before us does today is it keeps us competitive in this this niche industry in the state of Alaska. There are several states throughout the country that kind of specialize in this particular area. We are one of them. But of course, just like anything else, it's a competitive industry, and so what we're attempting to do here is maintain our position. What this does for us is it allows for this trust business to flow this way, assets to flow this way, and what it does for the attorneys, the legal industry in the state, the accounting industry, the banking industry, is what a lot of us refer to as being a clean industry. Now, of course, I'm not a trust attorney myself, so I came prepared with.
Came prepared
with folks that can answer specific questions. I'm available for general questions. I'll just wrap it up there.
Okay, thank you so much. Can you just stand by? I'm going to go to the public testimony, but if you can just stand by. Okay, let me start with Steve Greer, my old friend Steve Greer. Are you there?
Hello, Madam Chairman. This is Steve Greer.
Hello.
Are you there?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I want to indicate in general terms that I'm very supportive of this bill, but I truly think that I need to defer to the drafters of the bill. And I can indicate there are three principal drafters in this bill, and they are Dave Chaptel, Jeff Chapman, who I believe might actually be there, and Jonathan Blockmacher. And each of them had responsibility for certain sections of this bill. But I do want to indicate that I am very supportive of this bill. I have heard absolutely no objections from anyone, and most of this is a cleanup matter. That's really all I have to say.
You can talk.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, next, Dave Chaptel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of House Judiciary. My name is Dave Chaptel, and I'm a member of this group of attorneys and trust officers who have participated in drafting bills that have been proposed before the legislature since 1997. This particular bill is a continuation of a number of provisions. Some are technical corrections, some are procedural, some are several new provisions. They're all, in my view, very sound. They will assist us in doing estate planning and trust and estate administration for our clients who are Alaska residents, and they'll also make us competitive in the arena that Brian discussed with you, which are non-residents of Alaska who desire to do financial transactions and trust transactions in Alaska. We really are the foremost now of eight states that have these types of laws, and the legislature has really kept us there in front of these other states. We're very competitive in all the trade journals and articles that are written about in the state trust area that are written about these laws. Alaska is recognized as a leader, so this legislation will help keep us there. Be happy to be answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chaptal. Representative Gruenberg.
This would either be for Steve Greer, Dave Chaptal, or Beth Chapman. And I'm just sort of, Dave, since you're there, this is Max. I'm sort of picking on you, but if Ms. Chapman could come up, I could ask my question now on one particular section of the bill.
Okay.
And I don't know which one of you, and I was just talking with Brian and Doug
State your name
about
for the
this, too.
Beth Chapman.
Okay.
My question, folks, relates to Section 14 of the bill. And who, let me ask the question, and one of you can decide who wants to answer it. This is the section that deals with divorce law, so it's something that I have more than a passing interest in. And just for the folks on the committee who may not have studied this as much as I did, the rule now will be if you have a spendthrift trust, it's not generally considered property that's going to be divisible in a divorce. That's the general rule. That's the first sentence on lines 21 through 25 on page 7. However, and this is the sentence I'm looking at, folks, there's an exception to that. Unless otherwise agreed to in writing, that would be in a prenup or something, a nuptial agreement. There's an exception that you can divide it. The subsection does not apply. You can divide it if the person who sets this up is it's in a self-settled trust. In other words, they're putting their own money in trust.
Right.
With respect to assets transferred to the trust after the settlor's marriage. In other words, if I get married and I set up a trust and put my property into it, the court can divide it in the divorce, which seems to me eminently fair because that sort of thing would likely be potentially fraudulent. Are you folks with me so far? Okay. This is my question. I think we should add a phrase that would be the following. Unless it's transferred to the trust after the marriage, and this would be the phrase, or immediately before the marriage in contemplation of marriage, so that you can't do it after the date you get married, and you can't do it immediately before to skate out from under the law.
The only question I have on immediately in contemplation of marriage is, if you aren't legally married yet, then don't you have all the rights and privileges afforded to somebody who's not legally married yet? And then that's question one. And question two is, what about prenuptial agreements?
Well, a prenuptial agreement would be otherwise agreed to in writing.
Okay.
So that takes that out.
Okay.
But here, if you're doing it immediately before the marriage, in contemplation of the marriage, that is essentially during the marriage.
I don't follow that.
The reason being that what they're doing is saying...
I already did this to Tom, so I'm trying to defend my position.
you had some of the same questions I do about this. Okay.
I'm joking.
Maybe I don't go there.
I'm joking, Max. I don't have anything to put in my trust.
With your vast estate.
Nothing to put in my trust.
Only Dashka.
Right.
The thing is that the reason they have that second sentence there is so that you can't set up a trust to take your property out of the marriage if you do it during the marriage. But I don't see any difference between that and if the person does it immediately before the marriage, in contemplation of the marriage, the purpose being so that the spouse, the divorce court, if they do get married, can't get at it.
Ms. Chapman, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair, I believe Mr. Chaptal would be better suited to answer this question.
Can I stick Thwaites online?
Madam Chair.
This is Dave Chaptal, right?
Yeah.
Dick is not. Okay, did you want to respond, weigh in on the conversation?
Yes. This provision was really added, we feel it states what the law is right now in Alaska. In other words, right now, prior to marriage, one of the spouses to be can transfer her property into a self-settled discretionary spendthrift trust, and those assets would not be subject to division of divorce subsequently. We think that is the law. In other words, Representative Grunberg's concern, we think that's the law right now. We put this provision in, this extra sentence, to make it clear that someone could not abuse this provision after marriage and couldn't take the action of taking her assets after she was married and putting them into a self-settled discretionary spendthrift trust and then having those assets protected against a property division in a subsequent divorce. So this is really a safeguard sentence that clarifies that because we are one of these eight states that has this type of a trust, we don't want to see it abused, and we don't want to see a spouse try and set up that kind of a trust after marriage. Now, prior to marriage, which is what the timing that Representative Grunberg is focusing on, prior to marriage, as I said before, that can be done right now. A fiancé may take her assets, transfer them into a self-settled discretionary spendthrift trust, and the law is right now those assets would not be subject to division subsequently. And I guess, you know, personally, my opinion is that I don't see the abuse that to be concerned about if someone does do this, let's say immediately prior to marriage. I mean, that is something like a unilateral prenuptial agreement. If this person's fiancé was not agreeable to a prenuptial agreement, and the remedy of the other fiancé is just not to proceed with the marriage if he or she objects to this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson, and then Grunberg.
Hi, this is Tom Anderson. So in a nutshell, what you're saying is this section prohibits a married party from transferring after the consummation and the marriage certification, transferring into one of these trusts to then try to subsequently protect their assets. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
Do you not understand that? Because that's why I read it in Labor and Commerce, too.
No. Mr. Shaftel, members of the committee, unless there's a new case that says what you're saying, the current state of the law, and I'm reading from AS 25.24.160 subsection G, which is the main divorce statute, says, in a judgment in an action for divorce or an action declaring the marriage void or at any time after judgment, the court may provide, and this is sub 4, for the division between the parties of their property, including retirement benefits, whether joint or separate, acquired only during the marriage in a just manner and without regard to which of the parties is at fault. And then this is the kicker clause. However, the court, in making the division, may invade the property, including retirement benefits of either spouse acquired before marriage, and this is the kicker, when the balancing of the equities between the parties require it. That is the normal rule. You normally can't do it unless there are special circumstances that require that the court do it. And when they talk about premarital property, and this is at the heart of divorce law in this state, involving premarital property, they also consider property acquired during the marriage by inheritance or gift. That's considered separate property as opposed to joint property. But this language on lines 20 through 27, the way I read it,
since this is a new statute, says, in the event of a divorce or dissolution, the beneficiary's interest is not considered property subject to division. That would mean under subsection 160. That, and the other one is the dissolution statute. It's the same language. That would mean, in my opinion, the court couldn't even invade it if there are special circumstances where the balancing of the equities required. It's an absolute bar. And I think it should be, under the current law, that they can't invade it. They treat it as separate property. That's the status of the law now. David, is there some case that's directly on point that has modified the law that I've just stated that I'm not aware of?
So, Mr. Sheftel, when you respond, then I want to hear your position on the legal aspects. If you believe there's case law on point that states an opposite viewpoint than that of Representative Gruenberg's, and don't speak so much about the policy. In other words, if the policy's up to the committee, but I want to hear the legal part.
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm not aware of a case such as what you're describing. I think there's a very important policy here, and Madam Chair, I'd be happy to address that, but you've told me not to,
It's okay. Go ahead. I just want you to focus on the legal part, too, so we can clear that up.
Okay. The policy that I can speak for myself, and I've discussed this with all of the other estate planners who are members of this group and with a number of attorneys outside of Alaska. When our clients, let me give you an example, the parents come in and they do estate planning for their children and they leave assets in trust for their children. Their primary concern when we talk about asset protection, we talk about preserving assets, protecting assets that they have acquired during their lifetime. They've spent a lifetime working in their profession or their occupation or their business. They've acquired these assets. They want to leave them to their children or grandchildren. They want to leave them in trust for their beneficiaries. The foremost concern that I have heard again and again over 35 years of practicing in this area is the concern that if there is a divorce, that the assets which they have attempted to leave, let's say, to their daughter, end up being divided between their daughter and
the ex-son-in-law. This is a self-settled trust. It's not
son-in-law. Or vice versa.
But this is self-settled.
So this is the primary concern, and this is in many states, such as several large states, California, New York. Their statutory law expressly provides that assets in trust cannot be divided in a subsequent divorce. And recently there have been some cases in Colorado and several other states that essentially have surprised the bar with results that have gone in a variety of different directions and have created some concern in this area. So there have been articles presented at national conferences which describe these concerns, and we have stepped up and proposed this provision to clarify, because state law is what really governs here. Representative Gruenberg has pointed that out. So this provision is designed to clarify in Alaska that if, in the example that I described, and I'm sure there are many other examples, but the example that I described, when the parents leave those assets in trust for their daughter, that if there's a subsequent divorce, their daughter divorces, that those assets won't end up in their son-in-law, ex-son-in-law's possession. And that's the policy point that is extremely important with this provision. And as I say, state law ultimately will control. So this provision is designed, really, Representative Gruenberg, to clarify that policy in Alaska if the legislature approves it. so that we don't have these kinds of surprise results that are unfortunate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruber.
I totally agree with what Mr. Shaftel has said, whom I think is a great estate lawyer, and the other folks who are here, too. They're also excellent attorneys. But I'm not talking about that. That's the first sentence, lines 21 through 25. I'm looking at lines 25 through 27, which deals with a self-settled trust. What that means, folks, is that's a trust you set up for yourself. It is not a trust somebody else sets up for you. I absolutely agree with what Mr. Shaftel said. This is really important that most parents are concerned that the money doesn't go in the divorce. But that's the first sentence. We're talking here about where somebody, and the way the text reads now, during the marriage sets up their own trust, so they bring it in under the first sentence, and we don't want to allow them to do it. And all I'm saying is if somebody sharp decides to do this the day before the marriage so that it can't be dealt with as separate property, it would clearly be separate property because it's money you had during the marriage. Now, if it's money particularly, they're talking about assets transferred to the trust after the marriage, so it's even worse. The second sentence, the unless otherwise agreed to sentence, is a situation where, well, no. I'm waiting for some. I don't want to have to say this twice. Okay. This is a situation, there are two things going on here. And the sentence, the text sentence, 25 through 27, deals with two things. It deals with when the trust is set up, but more importantly, it deals with when the property was acquired. This is talking only about assets transferred to the trust after the marriage. And what I'm saying here is the spouse-to-be sets up the trust the day before the marriage with a dollar in it. And the money that comes is transferred to the trust after the marriage. And it may or may not be separate property coming from somebody else, who knows, or coming from a gift or whatever. But it may even be property during the marriage that's acquired during the marriage.
The only thing is, at least the way you propose the amendment, it doesn't clarify that because you're saying trust assets set aside in contemplation of a marriage. It could well be the case that you did have a situation where a person is a procrastinator, waited, maybe even had conversations with their soon-to-be spouse. You'd hope if somebody's planning on getting married that you'd have those kind of discussions, but some don't, and sets up a trust and puts aside these assets, let's say for their children, and then goes on and gets married, and let's say all the assets are put in at that time, but it's still in contemplation of marriage. So it's not your situation that you're describing where you put in a dollar, a nominal amount, and then later backfill it. You put that money aside, you get married, and then later, under the court ruling that you just cited, and without clarifying it in state law, a judge says, well, we are going to invade the corpus of that trust for equitable purposes, and we believe that in order to have a fair shake for the spouse, we're going to invade that. And that completely deteriorates the purpose for which it was set up by the person who put the money in.
Yeah. No, that's not my intent in saying this.
But the way you're phrasing
the language I was thinking of obviously is too broad, so I will concede that. But what I'm talking about is a situation where somebody sets up a trust to put property in it, sets this trust up immediately before the marriage in contemplation of the marriage. And what we're talking about is something where the money would either, with himself as the beneficiary. I'm not talking about maybe I'm wrong in the self-settled trust. Is a self-settled trust, can it be, I thought a self-settled trust was a trust you set up for yourself with yourself as the beneficiary. Am I wrong on that, folks?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Sheftel.
Yes, it's Madam Chair and Representative Grinberg. You're correct as to what a self-settled trust is. Could I make a suggestion?
Sure.
First, let me ask, what period of time would you consider immediately before? Could you quantify that in terms of days?
I would say a month, something like that. I'm talking about, because, Mr. Hove and I were talking about timelines, but I'm talking about something where you are absolutely about to get married. You're not talking about 6 months or a year out. I'm talking about something where you know you're going to get married, and really what you're trying to do here is to defeat your spouse's interest in what they would have under 2524160.
Could I make a suggestion?
Mr. Sheftel, Chair McGuire had to step out to meet with a senator, and we'll be right back. This is Vice Chair Anderson presiding now. And before you answer that question and give your suggestion, wouldn't there be a defense? I guess it would be maybe not a defense, but wouldn't there be an argument by, you're painting it like it's the male. Let's say it's a foreign wife who comes in, who the male marries, and the female doesn't understand U.S. law. He sets it up connivingly, is ready, and 5 years in, however many years in, does what you said, then puts everything into his trust, which he set up a day in advance or 3 days in advance of the marriage. Similar to like when someone gets a life insurance policy and then they kill their spouse. And I mean, in my opinion, there's a history there or a pattern that you could see and you could research. And you could see, wait a minute, this is fishy. It was too close to the time. How convenient. Mr. Sheftel, wouldn't that be an argument for the spouse, in this case, in our hypothetical, the female, to say, wait, you set that up in advance. It was very obvious that you did that. And wouldn't that be the argument rather than changing the statute and the bill?
I think it's important to understand that it really doesn't matter when the trust is set up under this provision. The trust could actually be formed and signed prior to marriage or after marriage. What is important is when the assets are transferred to the trust. That is the key, and that's the key under trust law. Whether it's a tax issue or whether it's an economic issue, the focus is always on when our assets transfer to the trust. So here what we're talking about, and Vice Chair Anderson, in your hypothetical, if 5 years after marriage some substantial amount of assets were transferred to a self-settled trust, whether that trust was created before marriage or after marriage, those assets would not be protected under this provision from being considered and divided in a subsequent divorce action. And that's why we put this provision in there. Now, there's a policy answer to Representative Grunberg's concern, and that is if assets are transferred before marriage, whether it's a minute before marriage or a year before marriage, those assets are still the assets that belong to a person who is not yet married. And unless there has been some kind of representation made to the fiancé, such as if you marry me, I have $1 million, and that's why you should marry me. Unless there's some reliance on a representation like that, a policy argument can be made that a transfer before marriage should be completely protected and the timing doesn't make any difference. However, and so that is certainly one position the committee could take and just say, we agree with that policy and we will not add any further language here.
And that's it. This is Chairman Anderson. That's a good example. That's how I got Representative McGuire to marry me. I told her I had $1 million. Now I've got to find $1 million.
I'm sure there are other qualities there that she would consider.
I'm not so sure about that.
Hey.
Could I suggest, though, that if you were to amend this and add language, It would be very simple to add a provision that would say, in effect, that if a transfer was made to a trust within the 30-day period prior to marriage, and if a transfer is made within 30 days prior of marriage, that the transferring party needs to give notice to the other party that such a transfer is being made. Now, that would allow the fiancé to certainly be aware of what's happening, and if this was a concern, then that fiancé would have the choice not to enter into the marriage.
So would that be, this is Chairman Anderson, so that maybe like in an affidavit or something that's attached to the trust that the future spouse acknowledges, recognizes the trust has been formed? Something like that?
That's correct. And I think you could just say that we're looking here, it says unless otherwise agreed to in writing by the parties or unless written notice of a transfer is given within 30 days prior to marriage.
Dave, Representative Wilson has a question.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens, though, if the marriage has happened, and then during the marriage, there is some money transferred to that account? That kind of, to me, I don't know, because I'm not an attorney, but to me that kind of mixes the money then. And so what happens then?
Representative Wilson, this is a common situation dealing with trusts and any assets and the growth of those assets that were transferred after marriage would not be protected by this provision. In other words, those assets could be divided if there was a subsequent divorce.
May I say something here?
Representative Grubing, and could you speak to his recommended amendment?
Let me put that, yeah. First of all, it sounds like a good amendment to me, what you're saying, Mr. Shaftel. But to answer Representative Wilson, you're looking at two different, we in that hypo are looking at two different things. First, we're hypothesizing, that's the word, that the trust that we're talking about is a self-settled trust, which means it's a trust that Peggy sets up for herself with herself as the sole beneficiary. That being said, the real question is what is the source of the funds?
Joint or separate.
Yeah. If the money you're putting into that trust is money you've acquired from your Aunt Polly, a gift or a bequest, and it goes into your self-settled trust, then it would be separate property which could only be invaded under the divorce law if the special equities required it, what I just read. If it's marital money that's put into that, that would be considered marital funds. Isn't that right, Mr. Shaftel?
Yes.
Now, to your...
Could Peggy have... do you want an address to bill her for this?
No. If, from what Mr. Shaftel is saying, I think that sounds like could be the genesis of an acceptable amendment to me.
So we can move on because of the bills. Does that satisfy you then?
What I would suggest is we have to come up with some language, but that's the concept I would... I think. Do you want to say it again so we're sure we've got it?
Representative, I think the concept, and I don't have a smooth amendment right now or language that I think is perfect, but the concept would be, and so let me state it a little bit more in more length than I think it should be in the bill, but the concept is that if someone transfers assets into a self-settled trust within 30 days of marriage, that party must give the fiancé notice of that transfer in order to obtain the protection provided by this new provision. And so I think that I can boil that down to a phrase, but it's going to take me.
Well, that's okay, Dave. What we'll do, we've done so many conceptual amendments where we've had more ambiguity than that one. Max, is that fine? Do you move that conceptual amendment as repeated
just
twice now?
That's me. Learning how to use this.
Okay, so if assets
ours figuring it out, what that is?
If assets are transferred by one party to the marriage to a self-settled trust within 30 days of the marriage, within 30 days before the marriage, that the transferor, that party, must give written notice to the other party of the transfer. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think that's would be a beneficial. We could just add a sentence to that effect at the end here.
Okay.
In order, the purpose would be in order to take advantage of the second sentence there, which is not the way we'd phrase it.
That's correct.
The purpose is in order to come under the second sentence.
The committee secretary understands your amendment and has written it down. We also have it on record now three times with confirmation. I appreciate your detail on that. Is that your conceptual amendment number one?
Yes.
Is there any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so moved, and we'll have legal services draft that properly and make sure you take a peep at it.
And I would like to also run it by, of course, Mr. Hove and the folks, the trust people, and Mr. Shaftdale.
Okay, so now we will go to any other testimony. I don't think there is any testimony against the bill. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. I know we have Doug still. Dave, why don't we go to Mitch Gans? I remember talking to him in Labor and Commerce. And then we'll go to Jonathan and then Rick. And then it looks like Dick Thwaites is called in, Pat Luby, and we'll wrap up with Doug. So, Mitchell Gans, please.
Yes, thank you very much, Vice Chair Anderson. My name is Mitchell Gans, and I teach at Hofstra Law School in New York. I testified, I spoke the other day about this bill. I spoke about the statute of limitations provision. I don't want to take up time unduly if not necessary. It seemed to me to be rather straightforward. I can just tell you, I can repeat what I said the other day briefly. I first got involved looking at this question when I was asked to consult on a matter. Someone wanted to create a trust, and we looked at we compared law, and we looked at Alaska, and we saw that the statute of limitations was 24 months on an interim accountant. And we looked at Florida law, which had a 6-month period, and as a result, they wound up refusing to come into Alaska with their money. When I looked at it more carefully and reflected on it, it seemed to me that the provision was rather problematic, both in terms of equity and efficiency from a policy perspective. I thought that in terms of equity, it seemed to make little sense to me that you could do a formal accounting, and if you do a formal accounting, you go to court, you can trigger a period of, I think it's 60 days, 90 days, depending on how you read the statute. But if you don't do a formal accounting, you just do it informally, you wind up with a 2-year statute. So it seemed to me to be unfair and equitable to make that discrimination. In terms of efficiency, it would seem that if you want to, if the trustee wants to qualify for the shortened period, for the 60-day or 90-day period, they simply have to do it formally by petitioning the court. And if they do that, they can trigger that shorter period. But if they just want to, if they want to avoid the cost of a formal accounting, formal petition, then they have to wait 2 years. So what the consequence of that, of course, is it imposes costs on the trust in terms of having to go to court, do a formal, go with a formal proceeding. And, of course, those costs are going to be borne by the beneficiary. So it creates that inefficiency, and that creates the cost, and it adds insult to injury of course, is ultimately borne by the beneficiary. And finally, just in terms of protecting the rights of the beneficiary, it would seem that if you give the beneficiary a notice saying you've got 2 years, a beneficiary might very well tend to procrastinate and ultimately, as a result, be lulled into a sense of, you know, I'll put it off and put it off, and ultimately not really focus on their rights and allow the statute to run inadvertently. Whereas if you shorten up the period and create a focused time frame within which they must decide whether to take action or not, it seems to me that it's more likely that the beneficiary would focus on their rights and protect their rights rather than allow them to, you know, expire or lapse inadvertently. So I don't think this is controversial, and it seems to be rather compelling. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take.
Thank you, Professor. So, Professor, have you spoken with Senator Seacon himself or his staff or
no.
Beth or any of the folks supporting of the bill?
I haven't.
Okay. Beth, can you respond to his concern? Or did he have – I mean, I thought he had a concern.
I have spoken, Vice Chair Anderson, I have spoken with Professor Gans, and I believe we have addressed all the concerns that he had in alleviating the inconsistencies between an interim and final report and having set for statute of limitations.
Okay. Does that suit you, Mitch,
yes.
What she just stated?
Oh, yes. I think the bill, I'm sorry if I
read you you talk so much about your concern that it sounded like, I guess I missed your conclusion, that sounded like you still have a concern. So you say you support the bill, and that.
Without question, I think the bill solves all of the objections that I was
Because that's what I remember you reporting in Labor and Commerce. I was like, oh, God, did I miss something in that committee? So perfect. So you endorse it, and I appreciate the senator for working with these folks to try to get those squared away. Do you have a question, Representative Guerra?
I do. Professor, this is Les Guerra. I grew up on Long Island, and I just need to say, I need to get this off my chest. Hofstra should have gone to the NCAAs, so I know you share that view. They got rooked. I'm done. They got rooked. They should have been there. They beat George Mason twice during the regular season. I'm done.
We need an at ease so you can get your composure back.
Oh, did that annoy me.
Okay, any questions? Seeing, hearing none, we'll go next to Jonathan Blattmacher, must be Doug's relative, and then we'll go to Rich in Fairbanks.
Madam Chairwoman, this is Jonathan Blattmacher. His name is purely coincidental, I assure you. Only kidding, of course. I have been very much involved with the Alaska Trust legislation from its inception. It has been, I think, fantastic for my clients. I can estimate that probably 9 out of 10 of our clients who look at the Alaska law compared to that of now 7 other jurisdictions, which have substantially improved the way trust can operate and can be used for estate planning, 9 out of 10 choose Alaska. And I think that the proposals that the group has put together will certainly continue to mean that most of my clients will continue to use Alaska. Thank you very much for the
great. Thank you, Doug. And that's Madam Chairwoman Anderson to you. That's what they call me. Okay, thank you. Rich in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Rich Hoppers. I'm an attorney in Fairbanks. I've practiced in their trust and estates for the last 22 years, and I want to express my support for Senate Bill 298. I know the committee's time is precious today, so unless there are questions, I'll conclude my comments.
Doug, why don't you get prepared? We'll have Pat Luby next online, then Doug, then we'll end up with Dick Thwaites. Pat, are you there?
This is Pat Luby. I'm the director for AARP in Alaska. We appreciate all the work that has been done in the past, so I'm continuing work for this. Obviously, our members are the beneficiaries very often for the hard work that's gone into this bill. We just encourage you to continue to improve it and get it through.
Great. Thank you, Pat. So ARP endorses the bill. Next, we'll go to Doug.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Anderson. My name is Douglas Blattmacher, and I'm president of Alaska Trust Company. And again, I support this legislation. We think it just continues to improve what Alaska has to offer and will continue to attract business to the state.
Great.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll go next and last to Dick Thwaites.
Yes, Vice Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Dick Thwaites. I'm a private attorney in Alaska for the last 32 years actually, and a trust officer at First National Bank of Alaska and now with Anchorage Bank. I'm also a chairman of the board of the Alaska Trust Company, so I'm speaking in both capacities, and I do support this bill as it has been proposed.
Great. Thank you, Dick. Seeing no other questions or any questions for Dick, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing and hearing none, then we'll close public testimony, but keep everybody online, especially the experts and Doug and Beth here in case there are questions. Was there an amendment from you, Representative
Garrett? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got two questions, and so I was just going to wait for the testimony to be over, and some of the folks online or present might want to address them. Most of the parts of the bill seem fine. I always get concerned with these trust bills when they start, when I have this worry that they might limit the rights of beneficiaries in relation to trustees. And for those who haven't followed these trust bills before, the trustee is the person who manages the money, who manages the assets, and the beneficiary is the person who may be a handicapped person or a disabled person or a child. Or somebody who's otherwise needy who's the beneficiary of the money in the trust and often gets periodic payments and things like that. The only worry I have about the bill are there's two sections in the bill that cut down the period of time when a beneficiary can make a claim. And I'm not exactly sure that I'm convinced that part of those parts of the bill are needed. There's Section 6. And it says the beneficiary who now has the right to 90 days of notice of a court proceeding will only get 60 days, and that they have the right to file their claims right now 60 days after the court hearing, but that'll be limited to 45 days, so a total loss of about 45 days in the claims notification process for the beneficiary. That's in Section 6. And I guess I'm wondering, is that really needed? Do we really need to do that? We had this battle, I believe, about 2 years ago, and I believe that didn't end up in the bill.
Doug, do you want to take that, or Dick, or who would you like to?
My understanding that the reason that was made was to make it consistent with the probate code.
If I may, Representative Garrett, one of the reasons for this change was there was, as I read it, an inconsistency in the statute as it came out in 2003. As it currently reads, there was 90 days notice of the court proceeding required, and then the beneficiaries had 60 days after they received the report. But the time that the report is provided to the beneficiary and the time that the petition is filed can be two different times. So one is we wanted to tie everything to the same date so that all time limits are going to come from the same date. The reason for the shortening was because we are trying to make the trust laws more in line with the probate code so that there's not going to be a lot of distinction between whether you're using a trust or you have an estate and you're a beneficiary of an estate. This provision, even at 60 days and 45 days, is substantially longer than is currently provided under the probate code. If I am representing a personal representative of an estate and I intend to issue my final accounting and file that with the court and ask the court to approve the accounting and close and terminate the personal representative's authority, I am only required under the probate code to provide 14 days notice of the hearing. And and that means we usually get our hearings within 14 days, and the beneficiaries are not given any additional length of time in which to respond. The probate code also has a provision that allows us to give notice of the distribution of the estate to a beneficiary with 30 days notice. And that's it, 30 days. And if they don't object within the 30 days, their rights are terminated. So while we are trying as we move forward with these bills to align trusts and estates similarly, we didn't feel it was appropriate to go so far as the probate code when we're working with an estate. So we came up with what we believe is a reasonable time limit that puts people on notice, still gives them a significant amount of time, more so than even if you were served a complaint, in which case, as you know, you only have 20 days to respond to. and yet give them plenty of time in which to respond if we are, in fact, using the court.
The Chair, Representative Greer, response?
This is sort of complex. Section 6 gives you 60 days to file your complaint. Section 7, if we don't change the law, that addresses a part of the law that gives you 2 years. What's the difference between the claims that you get currently get 2 years for in Section 7 and the claims that you currently just get the 60 days for in Section 6?
Representative Guerra, the 60 days is if we are going to use the court to approve the accounting. So if we go to court and ask the court to formally approve the accounting, then it's the 60 days notice. If we are, under the current law, if we are going to rely on just the general statute of limitations and it's an interim report, then it's a 2-year limitation period. Of course, we are proposing to reduce that to 6 months so that there's no distinction between an interim and final report.
I guess without a level of understanding of this area of the law that I don't think the committee is going to get, I'm uncomfortable reducing the amount of time that a beneficiary has to file a claim against a trustee. The claims could be for the trustee overcharges. There's a good faith debate about whether the trustee is overcharging, but after a while, the beneficiary who may be handicapped, somebody else stands up for the beneficiary later on, says, you shouldn't have paid that extra $1,000 to the trustee. Well, I mean, I'm uncomfortable cutting the time that the beneficiary has to file that claim, and then same in Section 7. It seems the 2-year statute of limitations is very consistent with the statute of limitations most people have in most areas where they've been wronged. And then to cut that down by 75% down to 6 months concerns me. When the bill was originally pitched to me, it was pitched to me as sort of a cleanup, and I always ask this question when these bills are pitched to me, which is, does it do anything to limit the rights of beneficiaries? So Section 6 and Section 7 are my concerns. Will it make your? I mean, I don't want to compete with other states to make sure we protect we withdraw sort of rights the beneficiaries have as much as other states have. That's what I don't want to compete with.
Representative Guerra, if I may, I think it's important that we sort of look at the history of this statute. And when we talk about trusts and estates, in comparing that to claims at law, a personal injury claim, which has a 2-year statute of limitations, trusts and estates are generally not subject to any of those limitation periods because they are equitable in nature. And it's important we go back and look at the history of the statute of limitations provision for trusts. Prior to the 2003 Act, there were two limitation periods. The first limitation period was that if a final account was provided to the beneficiary, it was a 6-month limitation period. And if there were no final accounting, or excuse me, if there was lack of full disclosure, which means even if you received a report that did not fully disclose everything, it's a 3-year statute of limitations. When we proposed the bill in 2003, we were looking to eliminate the distinction between an interim report and a final report, and saying that any accounting that is, and the reason we use report rather than accounting is because accounting has very legal definitions of what is an actual accounting. And a report, but basically if we provide information about the trust to the beneficiary, we wanted to make sure that there was a limitation period that was the same, whether it was while the trust was still going on or while it was a final report terminating the relationship. So before 2003, there was no two-year statute of limitations. And in 2003, and I believe it was in this committee, a distinction was drawn between interim reports and final reports. And that was passed out. And I believe that causes significant confusion. And I think as we propose going back to a 6-month, we are looking to protect beneficiaries. And I represent a lot of beneficiaries. And what we have done is we've tried to balance that. I'll give an example. If we have an interim report that we issue on January 10th of 2006, and 4 months later, this trust is now terminating, and we're going to distribute out the assets to the beneficiaries, and we issue a final report. Well, that final report has a six-month limitation period, but that report I issued 2 months ago has a two-year statute of limitations. That can't make, it doesn't make any sense, and in fact, well, could potentially harm the beneficiaries who have received these assets and may well have to give them back if there was, in fact, a problem with it. So we're really looking to ensure that when we transfer assets out of trust, we do so with some certainty to the beneficiaries. In removing the interim report and bringing that to the same limitation period of 6 months, which existed prior to 2003, we have added additional requirements for the trustees to follow. Under this proposal, any report, any trustee that wants to rely on that six-month limitation period now needs to provide very clear language to the beneficiary of what their rights are and that there is a six-month limitation period. They have to fully disclose the information, and they have to tell the beneficiary of the six-month limitation period. If a trustee fails to do either of those, then they're not going to get the benefit of the shortened limitation period, and it will revert to the three-year limitation period. I believe that having two separate limitation periods for an interim and a final report will simply cause confusion. So when we brought it back to 6 months, we said, well, how can we protect beneficiaries? Well, let's give them actual notice. Trustees, you have to tell them what their limitation period is, and you have to do so in pretty big print. And if you don't do that, then, of course, they're not going to get the benefit of the six-month limitation period.
Representative Guerra?
I just feel that starting 2 years ago, and I can't remember, but there was an effort to limit limitations periods, and I think you have referenced maybe what happened was I had succeeded in allowing the limitations period to be partially reduced, and it seems to me that this is the second part of the reduction that wasn't allowed back then. I'm uncomfortable reducing the amount of time somebody has to claim that a trustee charged too much money, mishandled the trust. Beneficiaries are normally people in very delicate and trying circumstances, and it could very well be that I just don't understand this well enough, but I'm uncomfortable changing the law in that regard.
I've heard Representative Guerra's testimony. I just joined the committee. I'm sorry. I had another meeting briefly. Can somebody from the bill's sponsor side explain their position, just in a nutshell, to me? I apologize to make you repeat it. If you want to, Beth.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, on the statute of limitations.
Yes.
The position is that when the bill was when this provision was adopted in 2003. There were separations of the statute of limitations for what we call an interim report, which is a report that's issued while the trustee is still administering the trust, versus a final report which terminates the relationship. And for reasons that I don't understand, there were two different periods that were adopted. One was 2 years for an interim report, and one was 6 months for a final report. And it's our position that's going to cause confusion to beneficiaries. The example I gave is if we have a report that's issued in January of 2006 while the trust is being administered. 4 months later, we terminate the trust and we want to distribute the assets and we issue a final report. We have two different limitation periods, 6 months from the final report, but yet 2 years to go back to that report we issued in January. So to balance bringing those and making no distinction, and we would be one of the, the only state to make a distinction of that nature, to bring it back to any report into a six-month limitation period, we have added a requirement that wasn't there before, that there be bold language added to the report notifying the beneficiary of that limitation period.
Representative Guerra.
The reason why I don't think that's confusing is most beneficiaries have never had a prior trust. This is the only one they've ever had. And you give them notice each time you give them an interim report. This is the amount of time you have to file a claim. So they get their interim report. They're told how much time. They get another interim report. They get a notice of how much time. They get the final report, and they're told, well, this is how much time you have from the final report. But it's not confusing to them because it's not like they've read the statute. They just get these notices that tell them what their time frame is. So I don't see why it's confusing to them.
Representative Guerra, I believe it is confusing, and I think it's confusing and could very well cause individuals to wonder what their ultimate limitation period is. If I have an interim report and I think I've got, and I've got 2 years to wait, and then I get another report that says I have 6 months, I'm not sure which limitation period, I wouldn't know which limitation period I would be under, and I even went back and read the law and said, well, I'm not sure what would happen when I have a situation that I, in fact, used as a hypothetical. Which limitation period is going to ultimately apply in that circumstance? And one of the things that we try to do with trusts and with estates and is to give certainty to beneficiaries so that when we distribute the assets out, that further claims aren't going to be made on those assets. Give you the example, if a trustee is in fact later accused of malfeasance in handling of the trust estate, and the court finds that the trustee did nothing wrong, the trustee was justified in every action that they took, well, the trustee is entitled to be reimbursed his or her legal fees from that trust. And we're going to, and so what's the trustee going to do? Is the trustee's going to go to the beneficiaries and say, okay, now you've got to pay back money to this trust so that I can be reimbursed for the claim that was brought by one of the beneficiaries. And of course, there may be multiple beneficiaries who will have to repay those funds. And if you have a 2-year limitation period, I believe you could find yourself with beneficiaries being harmed.
So in the effective date, there's no, it's not. Sections 2 and 3 take effect. It's not retroactive, any part of this bill.
Madam Chair, no, it's not.
Folks who have already had the benefit of the other statute of limitations will continue to have that benefit. Representative Anderson.
I was just going to say, I appreciate your, I mean, Representative Guerra has a point, and I see where he's coming from as a matter of public policy. Conversely, I think I side with the folks supportive in facilitating the bill. You know me, I'm the timekeeper. We've been 20 minutes on this. Can we just vote on the amendment? I'd love to do that, because I don't know what the other members think, but
okay,
I think they
so this is amendment number two.
Because I know Representative Guerra generally supports the intent of the bill.
I ask a question?
Sure. Representative Gruenberg.
Susan has a question.
Okay, so.
I just don't have that amendment.
Okay, Susan needs amendment number two. Has it been moved?
No.
Oh, it hasn't.
Madam Chair, it has not.
Do you want to go ahead and move it, Representative Guerra? Wouldn't it be, because didn't Representative Gruenberg's amendment pass as one?
Yep.
So amendment number two.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number two.
Okay. And there's an objection?
Amendment number two says the longer statute of limitations should be the 2-month to the 2-year statute of limitations, which is the same that you get in tort law. It's the same you get for most contracts. And I think it's the same that a beneficiary with potential challenges in their life should have. You should retain the 2-year limitations period when it involves a claim against the trustee for monetary benefits the trustee should or shouldn't have received. Sometimes the claim is you shouldn't have given money to this beneficiary instead of this beneficiary. I'm not so concerned about that. But when the claim involves money that the trustee arguably shouldn't have received because they charged too much and they weren't entitled to a fee or weren't entitled to a cost, in those cases, the claim against the trustee, I think that should remain at 24 months. So that's what amendment number two does.
Okay. Discussion, Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah. It seems to me there are two different issues here, actually three different issues. Number one is what the statute of limitations should be, and number two, should there be two different statutes of limitations? It sounds like Ms. Chapman's main argument is that, and I'm going to get to my third issue in a minute, but the main thing that she was saying is it's very confusing to have two different statutes of limitation. And I'd look at both. I'm trying to see if we can reach an accommodation here. That
I'm hoping on issue three you can bifurcate, or if it's such a word, trifurcate that into other issues.
You'll see where I'm coming from in a minute, Tom. That if it could be one single statute of limitations, and maybe Representative Guerra would consider that, then Ms. Chapman, maybe you'd consider what that ought to be. That's my first. My second goes to something that Ms. and this is the third part, actually. Third goes to something that Ms. Chapman said. She said that what this will ultimately be is if the trustee is successful, the trustee can make a claim for reimbursement by the beneficiaries. And this could be very hard on individual reimbursement, you know, beneficiaries. And as a practical matter, I'm wondering how that would occur and if there should be something in the bill to prevent that harm, maybe by a requirement that there be a bond or something maintained for the period of the statute of limitations. The only claim that could be made against the bond would be if there's an unsuccessful claim made against the trustee, that the bond would be only paid in that event to the amount of the trustee's legal fees and costs. But something that would basically make it easier for the beneficiaries to pay those costs in that unlikely event. Either that or retaining a portion of the trust for that. But I think that would be hard. I think a bond would be much easier, and it could be a bond under Rule 81, I think. That could be a bond that's basically we're worth a certain amount of money, and you know, so you don't have to get a commercial bond. You know.
So there's an amendment on the table.
Could I have my question answered? Would that be possible?
And sure, but we're completely out of order. But I will allow it. In other words, you should be speaking to whether you support or oppose the amendment.
Well, this went to the first part of those went to the amendment.
Total different track, but briefly, if you want to respond, and then let's dispense with this amendment.
Both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'll respond in reverse order, if that's okay, Representative Grunberg. As far as is this issue of receiving of a bond, many of the trustees that we're talking about are not corporate trustees who can post a bond.
No, I'm talking about the beneficiaries
the beneficiaries posting a bond. As Representative Guerra mentioned, many of beneficiaries may not have the ability to get a bond. We find this happens a lot in estates when we have personal representatives and there was a will and there's a bond requirement. They can't obtain a bond. Either they don't have the wherewithal to post a bond or the commercial bonds are very difficult to obtain and very, very costly.
How about, you know, the bond that you can do just under the court rule? Where it's, do you know the court rule I'm talking about?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay. There's a court rule, and it's not Rule 81. It's on bonds, and it specifically says that you can file a piece of paper with the court, and the court has to approve it, and it says, I am worth above the certain sum of money, and you fill that in. And this can be in cash, securities, real property, anything. So it doesn't cost a dime except for the minor cost of drawing this up, and frankly, you know, this, I'm sure they have commercial, I mean, you know, just legal document. Very simple. And it doesn't cost them a dime. And it's just if you have that amount, you know, if you have a house and you have an equity of $50,000, you just basically say, that's what I have. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. I don't believe that in the context of a trust and a distribution that makes sense to ask beneficiaries to post bonds. I understand the concerns about trustee fees. I understand that issue. However, when we are terminating a trust and with the fiduciary relationship between the trustee and the beneficiaries, it's very hard, I believe, to have a law that requires a beneficiary to post a bond to receive their distribution.
Okay, let's dispense with bond. Let's get back now to the amendment, the issue of whether or not. So the question is, we've already gotten your position on the amendment, and largely you testified to the fact that you thought the disparate statute of limitations might create confusion. So the broader question that Representative Grunberg wants to know is, if you create an equal parity, or if you create parity between the two, is there a different period of time other than 6 months that you support or not?
I do not. I believe 6 months is appropriate, Madam Chair.
Fabulous. Okay, let's get back to the amendment. So the amendment before us is amendment number 2. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number 2?
Representative Cott is not here. Oh, yes, he is.
No. Physically, he's here.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Mentally, he's in.
Representative Hawaii.
No.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Coghill is not here. Representative Guerra?
Yes.
Two yes, four no.
Okay, amendment number two fails to carry. Further amendments to Senate Bill 298?
I have one question.
Representative Gruenberg?
It goes to Section 6, and I'm not planning on an amendment here. Just Ms. Chapman, through the chair. This basically, the change from 90 to 60 on line 22 and from 60 to 45 on line 26, that makes this conform to the probate code, right?
Representative Gruenberg, it is more time than is allowed by the probate code. Probate code is 14 days for any hearing.
Who could possibly do that in 14 days? Oh, my goodness.
Okay, further questions on Senate Bill number 298? Okay, hearing none. Representative Anderson.
Can I make the motion then to move the bill out of committee? I move Senate Bill 298 as amended with individual recommendations and I believe zero fiscal notes.
As amended. Zero.
And with our love.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, Senate Bill number 298 as amended has moved.
Thank you very much. We appreciate all your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hope. Thank you to all the testifiers.
Oh.
Okay, next we have House Bill number 413, and I don't blame Reggie Jewell for leaving, frankly. So his staff is here. Hi, welcome.
For the record, my name is Michaela Saito. I'm an intern for Representative Reggie Jewell.
Okay.
Please excuse the absence of Representative Jewell. He did have to return to the House Committee Finance.
Okay.
So, HB 413 establishes a standard of safety by reducing the ignition of a cigarette. Similar legislation has been introduced in the states of New York, California.
I don't mean to interrupt you. The presentation of the bill has already been made.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to.
It's my understanding. So,
okay.
We appreciate you being here, and if you could just stand by for questions and so on. I'm going to get to the remaining testimony on this bill, and then I'd like you here to be able, if amendments come up, to be able to dispense with them.
Madam Chair, just a parliamentary question.
Representative Gruenberg.
I seem to have a proposed CES.
Yes.
The F version. Is that what you want to consider?
I guess so. You know, I'm going to make a recommendation to you. Is Reggie up in finance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why don't you let him know that in about 15 minutes, if he could come down?
Okay.
Just so that he can answer questions. No offense to you, but we're going to get to a part where there might be some amendments and things, and I want to know from the member whether or not they're accepted. I'm going to take public testimony. There are 5 folks, but if you could just let him know. I'd appreciate it. Okay, Ketchikan, David Hull. Because I don't know the answer to that, Representative Gruenberg.
Can you hear me all right, Madam Chairman? Yes.
You know it.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is David Hull. I'm the Chief of the North Congress Volunteer Fire Department. And I'm also here representing Chief Scott Davis, who is the Fire Chief of the South Congress Volunteer Fire Department. My background in EMS and fire has been over 30 years, and I've been involved in lots of different situations, and unfortunately have had the opportunity to deal with several fire deaths in my career. Every fire death that I've had to deal with in my career has had a cigarette involved with it. The issue as I see it regarding this bill is very much a life-saving one, and has very, very little to do with what an industry wants and what an industry perceives it needs. I understand the pressures that a tobacco industry can place on a contentious issue such as this, a fire-safe cigarette, but the industry should not be a primary participant here. The people should be. And that's what I'd like to draw your attention to on the first page of the bill. Lines 6 through 14 basically laid out. Cigarettes are the leading cause of fire deaths in the United States each year, claiming 1,000 lives and causing 2,000 injuries and nearly $400 million in direct damage. Alaska, as I'm sure you're aware, leads nearly every category in this. The technology is there. simple technology to significantly reduce this carnage. And other states have enacted similar legislation to this, and Alaska should be one of the ones that joins this. We really need to look no further than CNN reports of a few weeks ago of how this legislation would benefit not just the people who choose to smoke, but the emergency medical services responders who have to respond when an emergency results in a inadequately discarded or an inappropriately discarded, cigarette. The severe fire aboard the Princess Cruises in the Caribbean was very stark realization of what can happen. Major fire at sea, over 100 cabins destroyed by this fire, one person dead. A discarded, unattended cigarette. Ketchikan has long skirted disaster on the cruise ship docks down here when people would discard lit cigarettes on the dock on a very dry day. And yes, it may be hard to believe, but it does get dry down here once in a while. When these cigarettes are discarded, they get in between the cracks of the docks, and a few hours later, the fire departments are called down and are fighting a dock fire. Most of them are small, but at least once a year, we get a major fire under the docks that has the potential of crawling underneath the buildings and causing economic disaster for the people of the downtown Ketchikan area. If not for the quick and expert response by the Ketchikan Fire Department, these fires would have easily spread underneath the buildings and simply burnt away the foundations of the millions of dollars in real estate, jobs, taxes, and not to mention the human lives that were put in danger because of this situation. And that's not even talking about the dangers that the firefighters face in responding to this.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Hull, for your testimony. I'm going to go ahead and ask the remaining folks, if you could please try to confine your testimony to just a couple minutes here. We've got three other bills on the agenda, and I want to wrap it up because this is the second hearing on this bill.
Okay, that's fine. If I could just make one final statement,
sure.
I would ask you to please choose lives over the needs of stockholders and shares and support this House Bill 413. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hull. And to the extent that any of you on the line want to simply say I support the testimony of Mr. Hull from Ketchikan, that's great too. Rusty Ballinger out of Anchorage.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rusty Ballinger. I'm the Assistant State Fire Marshal and Deputy Director of the Division of Fire Prevention with the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety does support the passage of House Bill 413, excuse me. Alaska does have a fire problem that we now have the means to address. The problem is that we have one of the highest per capita fire fatality rates in the nation. Over the last 10 years, one-fourth of our fire fatalities have been caused by cigarettes. Often those dying are not smokers themselves, but family members or friends. Through advances in technology and the tobacco market, we now have the means to address a significant portion of the horrific fire record. By requiring cigarettes to comply with burning standards already in place in the major markets in the U.S. and all of Canada, Alaska can begin to enjoy a reduction in not only fire fatalities but property loss as well. To gain an equivalent measure of fire safety, we would have to regulate mattresses, bedding, upholstered furniture, clothing, draperies, carpeting, and other home furnishings, and yes, the plant. All of these items are often ignited by carelessly discarded or unattended cigarettes. Rather than to regulate all of these items, it seems much easier to address the ignition source itself, the cigarette. This is not an anti-smoking issue. This is a life and property conservation issue. This is not a preferential treatment issue. All manufacturers can and do produce compliant cigarettes already. This will not affect revenues. It will not affect retailers. This bill makes good sense for Alaska, and I ask you to help us as we do what we can to reduce our fire loss record. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ballinger. Okay, Joanna Bales?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bales. I'm an audit supervisor at the Tax Division in the Department of Revenue, and I'm actually online to address some of the changes in the CS and There were a couple of recommended changes that the Department of Revenue had that were not made in the CS.
Okay.
I don't know if you want me to go through those before Representative Jewell.
Representative Gruenberg?
I was just talking to Michaela here on behalf of the sponsor. I think we need to have that CS in front of us. May I offer the CS?
Absolutely.
I move the F, as in Foxtrot, Bannister 4506 CS for discussion only.
Okay, is there an objection to adopting F for purposes of discussion? Okay, hearing none, we have F before us. Why don't, Joanna, if you'd just stand by for a second and let me hear from the sponsor's intern whether or not why they chose to adopt some changes and not others, or what the changes are.
Okay, thank you.
Basically, the changes are little technical things. The changes that Joanna is referring to either were not made into the were submitted to the legal but did not make it in for some reason, or not. Maybe it was just because there was a lot of if you can see, there are a lot of inclusion of the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner of Revenue. It might have just been overlooked.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set this bill aside and let you work it out with the Department of Revenue and come back on Monday, okay, at this stage. I just work it out with them and come back, if you don't mind, on Monday, okay? I appreciate it. Okay, let's go next to House Bill number 347.
Michaela.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
Chair, is Tom McGrath on the line? Do we know?
I do not know. No, he's not, says teleconferencing.
Madam Chair, just for the record,
Representative Gruenberg.
On the last bill, I said to Representative Jewell's assistant that I'll be happy to help them and offer the appropriate amendments.
Fabulous.
If we could take that up then, I'd be great.
Yeah, that would be great. If you want to get the Department of Revenue together so that they understand,
I think they'll coordinate.
We just don't have the time at this time of the year. People have got to be prepared when they come in here. Okay. So we're on House Bill number 347, and Mr. McGrath, are you on the line now? Okay. So is it possible to go forward without him, or do you need him here?
Yeah, it is. No, it absolutely is. Representative Anderson alerted him to the bill and wanted to see if we could add some things.
Now, Mr. Bannock is. Okay. Do you want him to go before you, or?
No, Madam Chair, do we need to talk about the bill again? I don't remember where we went last time.
Unless there are other members that need that.
Need what?
More talking about House Bill number 347. We've already had it. Okay. So
there's one. One of the easy things I could add in, and Mr. McGrath had a very valid concern. There really is, right now, no necessary punishment for the crime of driving without insurance.
Okay.
It is a crime, but it's a crime written under, I believe, an old statute where it's called a misdemeanor, not a Class A or Class B. And so there's no mandatory fine. There's the fine schedule for a Class B misdemeanor doesn't necessarily apply. And so Mr. McGrath made the point that it's actually cheaper to drive without insurance because you're probably not going to have to pay very much of a fine, and it's cheaper, and that's the fine that you would have to pay is less than the cost of insurance. So we wanted to I've got an amendment that would make driving without insurance a Class B misdemeanor, and say that the fine has to be at least $500. The maximum limit for a Class B misdemeanor is already in statute, but I think it is appropriate to say that if you drive without insurance, there's a $500 penalty for it.
Okay. So that'll be amendment number one. Mr. Bannock, you're on the line. Have you been provided a copy of amendment number one, or is it sufficient that you heard Representative Guerra describe it?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I think that would be actually outside the bounds of the DMV, that amendment.
Okay, so you don't wish to comment on it?
Correct, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't I go ahead, though, and just at least dispense with any other testimony that you wanted to offer, or are you just going to stay on for questions?
Very briefly, I would tell you that the DMV is in love with section number 3. That's the one that has the most to do with us.
Okay.
We're grateful to the sponsor. Thank you.
Fabulous. Okay, so Mr. Bannock's on the line with respect to section number 3. And so let's go back to amendment number 1, Representative Guerra. Do you want to move it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 1.
Is there an objection to it? Representative Cott? Representative Wilson? Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Okay, hearing no objection, amendment number 1 carries. Further amendments to House Bill 347? Further discussion? Okay, hearing none. Is there a motion? Representative
I'll move the
bill. Gruenberg.
Move the bill with individual, as amended with individual recommendations.
Zero fiscal notes.
Yes.
And the blessings of Dwayne Bannock on Section 3. Okay. Any objection? Hearing none, the bill's moved. Okay, that brings us to House Bill number 276. Whose bill is that?
Representative
Cott.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We've had this bill before this committee a couple of times, I believe. We've come back with a modified version of the original version,
okay,
which I think addresses some of the concerns. And the major change in the statute now that you can find in Section 1 of the bill, Section 1 of the bill increases the penalty from the $300 up to $750, and it also allows for those companies who may have sold to minors an opportunity to come before a hearing officer on their first offense. And the issues dealing with that hearing officer hearing is found in Section 3 of the bill, which determines what can be brought forward at the hearing. And that's basically the scope of the bill. As I said, it has been, there was some concern that we weren't treating these folks fairly with a hearing, so we have incorporated that hearing into the first offense only.
Okay. There's a CS then that needs adapting. And Representative Cott, this CS is reflective of what you just described. Version S. Can I have a motion on that? Representative Anderson?
I move the version you referenced, S, as in Sam.
Is there an objection to adopting that for discussion? Okay, hearing none, we have version S before us. There are folks to testify. What I'm going to do, public testimony has already been closed on this bill. That being said, there is a new CS. Most of the folks online are just online to answer questions anyway. For those who are not online just to answer questions, I'll go to you, but please confine your testimony to simply to the CS, meaning I'm familiar with many of the names. I know your overall position on smoking, on youth smoking, on if you're a corporate type, I know your position on the fairness issue and the due process. So really all I want to know now is what is your position on this CS? Please try to keep it brief. So with that being said, I will go to Roger Hames and Sitka.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Roger Hames, President of Hames Corporation in Sitka, as well as Triple C Ventures. We do business as four convenience stores and four supermarkets convenience stores here in Sitka. The committee substitute for House Bill 276 that's before me right now, it's something that's very difficult to live with. It's going the wrong direction for me, but it is something that I can live with, so I would support it. Thank you.
Okay, a mediocre endorsement. Okay, I always know I've reached a compromise on a bill if everybody's a little upset. So I'm looking to hear if everybody's a little upset. Okay, Ketchikan, Mike Ellerding.
President McGuire, I'm a little upset. Thank you very much. I support Representative Cox's work on this bill and the committee's deliberations, and we urge passage of this committee, passage of this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Monsonger. Dr. Monsonger?
Yes, I'm sorry. He stepped out for just a second. He will be here in just about 3 seconds.
Okay. Or we can come back to him.
Okay, that'd be great.
I'll do that. Okay, Cindy Drinkwater.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, a little louder.
I'll try to speak up and be closer to the microphone.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Cynthia Drinkwater, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law. I represent the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development in administrative hearings under AS 43 from the 075. And following up on comments made previously by the Department of Health and Social Services, I just wanted to mention three issues related more to, three legal or enforcement issues specific to the version test.
Okay.
Understanding what a little bit more about the purpose of the changes in the current draft. I think there is some confusion or the possibility for confusion in the language. For instance, on page 1, line 10, there's the phrase after a hearing under T of this section, which doesn't appear in the rest of subsection D. And I think that because of the language in T, it seems to suggest that paragraph T refers to all the subparagraphs of the. There's some confusion as to when paragraph C applies and when it does not.
Okay, what would make that clear more clear, Cindy? What change would make that more clear?
Well, I think that if the purpose is that the hearing applied to specifically to D1, then that could be made clear in subsection T. But if that change is made, then I think that the phrase in paragraph D that states notwithstanding paragraph M of this section needs clarification, because I believe that paragraph M under the current statute should still apply to D2 through 4.
Okay, what type of a hearing? So, but what we intend is for it to be a hearing that's described in T, correct?
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure I understood Representative Cott's comment.
Okay, Representative Cott.
That's correct, Madam Chair, what you just indicated.
Right, so I guess I'm trying to figure out what the confusion is. May, after hearing under T, suspend the endorsement. So what the goal of this CS, is my understanding, is to address the very first only violation of the law. In subsequent violations, shall suspend, and then you've got the days outlined. So in the very first section, what's being said, the sponsors proposed, is that you'll have a hearing that's governed by Section T, and that they may or may not. So the hearing officer will decide. They may actually suspend. They may not. So I don't understand the confusion. What type of a hearing would you envision?
I apologize if I didn't express myself clearly. That, I think, is clear.
Okay.
It's in the subsequent provisions, I think. That
okay.
If the hearing is supposed to apply for those as well.
Okay. So how do the subsequent sections make it clear that it'd be a hearing under something other than T? I see what you're saying. So it says under M?
Well, it was not clear to me from Representative Cott's comments whether T would also apply in the subsequent provision.
Okay. Representative Cott, do you envision T applying in the subsequent sections?
No.
No, he does not.
Second and third and fourth violations would not apply.
Okay, so second, third, and fourth violations, it would not apply. Okay, and so then it would just be confined to the subsections themselves, which say 45 days and impose a penalty, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So what you're saying is that they're not going to go through the hearing process on 2, 3, and 4.
Exactly. There's no hearing after the first offense.
Okay.
It's set out.
It's sort of like strict liability.
Then you might want to say instead of D on line 27, page 2, you might want to say D paren 1 close paren to make that crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
I would offer that. What do you think?
Yeah, that's
what do you think?
I would offer that as Amendment 1.
Okay. Amendment number 1 by Representative Gruenberg. Is there an objection to that? Okay, hearing none, that amendment carries. I think that does make it clear. Okay, Ms. Drinkwater, you want to continue in your testimony? Thank you for allowing me to be a little unorthodox. It just makes it go quicker if we can address things as you bring them up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next comment would be on page 3, line 1.
Okay.
The CS specifies that the notice, among other things, should contain the hearing date and time. This would prove difficult because in the initial notice, that goes out from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And
she doesn't say that.
The hearing information is within the purview of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. Okay, so let's think about what would make
Madam
that
Chair, I'll offer an amendment. Bloomberg. I would move that on line 1 of page 4, that we delete everything.
Three,
after,
you mean. Three.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Page 3.
After the phrase that may be imposed, period. We just put a period there because it's the hearing officers that set the date and time of the hearing.
Yeah.
So I just remove, we delete, as amendment number 2, we delete the phrase, quote, and the date and time of the hearing.
Representative Cott?
That's fine.
Okay. So amendment number 2 is on the table. Is there an objection to it? Eliminating that the date and time notification come from somebody who can't give it? Just sum it up. Okay, hearing no objection, amendment number 2 carries. Ms. Drinkwater, could you continue? Do your third?
I have a question.
Yep. Oh, Representative Wilson, pardon me, has a question.
If we take that out, the date and time, shouldn't we add that in? The hearing officer will set the date and time of the hearing plus determine the issues by using the, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's
make
that.
That's a good confirming amendment. Okay, so where do we want to put it?
That'd be number 3.
Yeah, where do we want to put it?
At the end of line 2 shall determine, and then we'd add the phrase, the date and time of the hearing, comma, the issues, et cetera.
Okay, and then do you want notice sent? Let's see, what was the goal of that? See, the goal of that other was that the notice would inform the folks that are going to be involved in it of the date and time and hearing. So do you want to require the hearing officer not only to set the date and time, but to provide notice of that?
Yes. Maybe let's put another sentence in at the end of line 1.
That seems fair.
Yeah, let's do that. So it would be, with the sponsor's permission and through the chair, this is a conceptual amendment that the Office of Hearing Appeals or whoever does this would set the date and time of the hearing and notify the parties.
Okay. Representative Cott?
That's fine.
Okay, so that's amendment number 3. That seems fair. Is there an objection to it? Good catch, Representative Wilson. Okay, hearing none, amendment number 3 carries. Ms. Drinkwater.
Thank you. My third comment was just for the committee's consideration that it appears that this change in the statutory framework will mean that there are increased numbers of hearings because retailers, licensees will have every incentive to request a hearing since there's discretion as to the amount of the civil penalty and as to whether a suspension should be imposed and the length of the suspension up to 20 days. Of course, that means that there will be increased attorney time and hearing officer time. In addition, with on the first offense with the lengthier hearing process and the number of issues to be determined, the proceeding will be more like it was prior to 2002 when the statute changed. Often these were lengthy hearings, multi-day hearings with numerous witnesses and documentary evidence. So I think that there will be increasing costs associated with the change in the statutory framework.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I'm going to go to Mike Ford.
Mike, be positive this time.
I'm positively happy to be here. my name is Mike Ford. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Native Health Board. And I have had a chance to digest the changes that we made in the CS. I have just a couple of comments. First of all, I think it's important for the committee to realize that, in our view, what we have is a very effective law now.
I think we all realize that.
Yeah, it's effective. It does the job it's intended to do. Now, the CS does make the changes that, and I know from some people's viewpoint, makes the law better. What we would recommend the committee consider is instead of allowing an optional suspension, that if you feel like you need to make changes, that in fact what you do is simply reduce the amount of mandatory suspension to a smaller number. That still leaves teeth in the law. It still leaves you with a law that effectively precludes sale to minors, which is the whole point of the law. But it would give some relief to those people who are retailers and who feel that they're under some onerous provision here. So rather than simply saying that it may be suspended, which leaves it up to the really to the decision of the hearing officer to whether have any suspension at all or not, if you were to reduce it to a smaller period, 3 days, say, we feel that would still be a deterrent factor that would still give some relief to your retailers.
I didn't know if you'd finished.
I do share some of the concerns, which I think you've addressed in terms of the confusion over the Section 3 on the hearing provision. Hopefully those have been fixed. Mm-hmm. But in essence, that's what I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Okay, next I'm going to go to, answer questions. Michelle Tuohy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good
afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon regarding House Bill 276 and specifically the most recent committee substitute version S in front of you. My name is Michelle Tuohy. I'm the Director of Public Relations and Advocacy for American Lung Association of Alaska. And I want to make a specific point, Madam Chair, to thank you for your efforts in considering this proposed legislation in such a careful and thoughtful manner. Specifically to the CS, while education efforts do have a constructive role to play, their value must not be overestimated. We know that businesses with education programs have been cited for making illegal sales. These illegal sales are plain evidence that an education program is not enough. The critical factor is active and diligent management, and that means there needs to be meaningful consequences in the case of a violation, including the first violation. The compliance data show us that once predictable, readily enforceable, and meaningful penalties were put in place under current law, illegal sales dropped dramatically. The various proposals that have been advanced this far, as HB 276 and subsequent drafts, would eliminate the certainty of a meaningful penalty for illegal sales in the case of a first violation. Under the most current CS, version S, it would be possible for a violation to occur and there be no penalty whatsoever. In conclusion, in order to preserve the effectiveness of the enforcement program, we feel strongly that some meaningful level of suspension is essential to maintain in the case of a first violation. Businesses that elect to engage in the sale of tobacco products have a very serious responsibility to ensure that they do not make illegal sales to children. Therefore, the American Lung Association Alaska does not support the CS version S as written because it does not include the guarantee of at least a minimum suspension on first offense. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle, for your testimony. Okay, Pat Luby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska.
And my constituent.
Yes, ma'am. And a happy one. AARP members come from a generation that spoke freely, and they know the terrible health and financial consequences of all those cigarettes. We don't want to see anyone's grandchildren start to smoke. We feel the state is doing a good job. They're using 15 and 16-year-olds for their test purchases. If the store is selling cigarettes to 15 and 16-year-olds, they should face the consequences. AARP recommends that you leave the system as it is and help Alaska continue to reduce youth smoking. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. I appreciate your testimony. I'm going to go back to Dr. Monsager.
Hello, Madam Chair. This is Dr. Monsager. Thank you for allowing me to be a minute late. I was down the hallway. You have already heard from other people. I'm speaking on behalf of the department. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health. And I won't speak to the background and issues with tobacco. Pat Luby just summarized that quickly. I just would like to quote one more quote from former commissioner of the FDA, David Kessler, who said, "Nicotine addiction begins when most tobacco users are teenagers, so let's call this what it really is, a pediatric disease." As you know, I'm a pediatrician. I think about this a lot. From the department's point of view, I would echo what the last two speakers say, that the current law is working. If you decide you need to change it, there needs to be some minimum mandatory suspension with the first offense. The enforcement actions only visit a small percentage of retailers in any given year. The chances there will be a second visit within 24 months is unlikely in most cases. And so if there isn't a mandatory suspension of some amount with the first offense, the likelihood that there will be any is very unlikely. And I urge you to maintain some suspension with at least the first offense. Thank you.
Dr. Monsager, what amount of time would you propose as a minimum?
I would propose that it be at least 3 days.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. The other folks that I have online have all said that they would be online for questions, and I'll announce who they are so that they're a resource to the committee. Ronald Taylor at Department of Health and Social Services, Suzanne Meunier, and Joe Darnell, all of which have testified before but are on the line in addition to the other folks I've had testify as resources to the committee for questions. Okay, so anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, then public testimony is closed. It brings the CS for House Bill 276 back before us for amendments and committee discussion. Representative Anderson.
I'll make a conceptual amendment number 4 because I still don't agree, and I'll speak to that prior to voting for the legislation, that there shouldn't be. I am on the polar opposite of the health and tribal, and I don't know why ARP testified. I love Pat Luby, but I don't see the relevance in Association of Retired Persons testifying in this bill. But I think that it is unfair to have on your first violation any suspension, and I can speak to that with the objection. I'm sure someone will object. I think we can push these and extrapolate these down so that there's the 20-day on the second.
I'm just trying to get your attention.
Oh, okay.
If at ease. Amendment.
My amendment is number 4, which is conceptual because I don't have it written out.
What would be
it? Would be
amendment number 4, is that right, Susan?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That we do not have a restriction of sales on the first violation, and that we don't have a restriction on the first violation, and then we have but we do have a hearing.
So what's the point of the hearing? You can't impose a penalty.
Yes, you can, a financial penalty.
Okay.
And then thereafter, the amounts go to the second, third, and fourth. So forth.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I mean, I can't. If you want me to go for the record and go to each subsection to say, basically, I'm moving it to the next. In the spirit of not believing there should be any restriction of sales on the first violation.
Okay.
Case in point. You have
conceptual amendment.
It's hard enough to hire kids in these convenience stores, and you get some dingbat who sells to an underage.
Okay.
I do not think that's going to change the statistics that the Tobacco Alliance has argued upon, that the current law effectively reduces underage smoking, and I think it's difficult enough to get people in there. If you've ever been to some of these convenience stores, God bless Holiday and Tesoro, and I think that those mistakes are going to happen. They're very, very infrequent, and it's not due to this law. It's because of good management, and one mistake affects that company. And 3 days of 100, 200 people coming in every day, that's 600 people that say, wait a minute, think of the shoppers in these stores. Wait a minute, they don't sell cigarettes? Well, I'm not going to come back here. Now they've lost that person. Again, you remember my analogy of from dog food to beef jerky to Snapple. And some of those folks live in my district. Jan's Distributing sells beef jerky, Snapple, and Winston's in Holiday. And now suddenly that affects them. Suddenly Holiday says, we're not getting the same clientele because of this 20-day imposition. Hey, Jans, we don't need to buy any of your Snapple or beef jerky. Okay. Pretty soon they're out of business.
Is there any...
Six of those family members...
I object to the amendment. Is there discussion on the amendment, amendment number four?
Question.
Representative Guerra.
Sure. We've hit the part of the session where, I mean, we have to get these bills to finance, I believe, before if they're going to get discussed on the House floor. On this one, I'm willing, and there's a commitment, I think, on the Finance Committee to do some work on this bill. I'm willing to see what they do in finance and then fight about it on the floor if we need to, but I don't know that I would maybe ask this.
I'll withdraw my amendment. I just wanted to get my point across.
Withdraw the amendment, and this will be one of those rare exceptions where, given
we'll
the time limits,
bill.
We go to finance and then we do the work on the floor if we
yep.
have to.
I agree to that.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
I'm going to offer an amendment that you have in writing.
Okay.
And that will be number 5.
Okay.
It's to page 2, line 27.
Okay. Okay, page 2.
The reason is just it's kind of a ministerial amendment that to save costs and time, it may be that neither party would request a hearing to allow that to occur. So there's a hearing unless either party there is a hearing unless that there's a hearing if either party requests it.
I
understand the sponsor has no objection to
that. I mean, that's the department shall at the request of either party. There may be a situation, I don't know off the top of my head how that would rise to the occasion, but there may be a situation where the seller, the owner of the business, decides they don't want a hearing.
They could submit it on documentation and pleadings.
Okay. So that's amendment number 5. Okay. Committee discussion. You've moved it, right? Okay. Is there an objection to it? Okay. Hearing none. Amendment number 5 passes. Is there a further amendment to 276?
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would move in light of the testimony in Section 1 that there be a mandatory minimum of at least a 3-day suspension.
I'd object.
Okay.
Conceptual amendment.
Okay, so it will be May after a hearing. How would that read?
Okay, but so shall, I'm sorry, May after a hearing under T of this section suspend the endorsement of a for, and it would be for a period of 3-20 days.
Okay, that's amendment.
That for a period, and that should be, I guess, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. That's amendment number 6.
Peggy, let's work on that finance. I pulled mine.
Okay, let me take a brief at ease. Record, and prior to leaving the record, Representative Grunberg had proposed amendment number 6.
I maintain my objection.
And Madam Chair,
and
the
Representative Anderson had objected. Representative Grunberg.
There's a parliamentary reason I'm doing it, and that's so that they will have, if this amendment passes, this committee's recommendation,
yep.
And there'll be a CS in front of the
yep.
whole House.
Okay, so amendment number 6, discussion. Okay, Madam Secretary.
Madam Chair, I'm going to object to Max's amendment this time.
Oh, okay.
And the reason being, if you put a minimum down there, I think there's going to be that notion that we can go to the minimum. We've already got up to 20 days, and I think the notion there is if they go before the hearing officer, you know, the chances of them, you know, if they're found guilty, they're not going to get 0 days. There's going to be some mitigating circumstances, and they're going to be looking at all the circumstances and issues surrounding this. And I don't want a hearing officer to see 3 days in statute and say, first offense, 3 days. You know, you're taking, I think, a notion that we want to keep the penalties higher by putting in the 3 days there. I just think you're going the wrong direction, where the hearing officer is going to say, well, legislature put in 3 days, so they must have meant first offense, 3 days, unless there's, you know, a whole number of issues that would be aggravators in this case. You know, sold it to 10 kids, when and I'm the owner, you know. But I think, you know, depending on the circumstances, if I were an owner of a convenience store and I'm selling them, that's different than a clerk. And if I'm the one selling them, I should get 20 days. If it's my clerk, maybe not.
I hadn't thought of it at two.
Representative Guerra?
With the
he's always rude.
I'm actually getting a little confused with where we're going, and I think the same thing applies to what I said about Representative Anderson's amendment, which is I think we should think this stuff through, see what comes out of finance, and follow this really closely, and work on our best conceived amendments on the floor on this if we have to. I think with everybody's agreement that they've got this deadline in finance, I think that's the better way to do it.
We're still on the trust bill.
and that we just vote down the trust bill in committee, just to save time.
Madam Chair, with that, I'm going to withdraw the amendment, not because on the merits, but because it's just too confusing.
Yeah. Okay. So there is there a motion to move the bill out?
Yes.
Okay. So moved.
With individual
Representative Gruenberg, with individual recommendations. Cannot stress enough that the movement of this bill today in no way endorses anybody's personal opinion on the bill. So moved. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.